Trend number two, putting the Great Stagnation behind us. The golden age of the fifth techno-economic revolution is upon us. In fact, as early as 2017, we had begun our escape from the so-called Great Stagnation, which started with the dot-com crash. But the COVID-19 shock has convinced many that mediocrity is here to stay. Fortunately, Wall Street anticipated the macroeconomic trend earlier than Main Street, and this triggered a secular bull market beginning in 2013, which is still going strong. Furthermore, from the vantage point of early 2021, it appears that rather than derailing the golden age, 2020's COVID-19 shock simply accelerated the institutional changes needed to facilitate full and effective adoption of golden age innovations as they emerge. And, as subscribers to Trends and Business Briefings already know, those innovations in technology and business models are appearing routinely at an ever-accelerating rate. Consider just one example reported recently by the New York Times. Artificial intelligence researchers at Google's DeepMind unit announced that an AI program had solved the mystery of predicting how proteins in the human body fold into 3D shapes. This long-sought breakthrough could accelerate our quest to understand diseases, develop new medicines, and unlock mysteries of the human body. Obviously, finding the solution to this 50-year-old riddle could turn out to be a game-changer for human health and longevity. But more importantly, this advance illustrates why we have legitimate reasons to believe that the long-term slowdown in technological progress is in the process of reversing. And that's exactly what the Trends editors have been anticipating since the transition began in 2000. Once that reversal happens, every manager, investor, and consumer needs to be ready for much faster economic growth and all the good things that go with it, such as higher wages and better quality of life. To be sure, this boom is not the current expectation from most economists. All but the most bullish forecasters expect only a growth blip over the next couple of years as the economy rebounds from the pandemic-induced shutdown. That probably means a booming 2021 and 2022 before a deceleration back to an uninspiring pace of around 2%, which we've been experiencing since the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office recently predicted that the economy's average growth potential will be almost a third slower than it has averaged over the past 50 years. But fortunately, history shows that the consensus and government studies tend to be wrong more than they are right. So, that begs the question, what would constitute an end to the Great Stagnation and the beginning of a productivity boom? Any precise cutoff would be arbitrary, but a reasonable definition for discussion purposes would be sustained growth in utilization-adjusted total factor productivity of 2% per year. For reference, mean average utilization-adjusted TFP growth from 1947 through 1972 was 2.1% per year. Since 2005, utilization-adjusted total factor productivity has averaged just 0.17% per year. TFP growth is defined as the change in real output that cannot be attributed to changes in factor inputs like more labor or more capital. And the utilization-adjusted series corrects for the business cycle, so it's one of the best metrics we have for measuring the impact of innovation on the economy. Why did TFP hit a wall for most of the past 15 to 20 years? Unfortunately, when it comes to growing TFP, scientific breakthroughs alone are not enough to drive an end to the Great Stagnation. TFP only budges when new technologies are adopted at scale, and generally this means products, not just science. Science lays critical groundwork for new technology, but after all the science is done, much work remains. Someone must shepherd the breakthrough to the product stage, where it can actually affect TFP. This means building businesses, surmounting regulatory obstacles, and scaling up production. Traditionally, economic growth is enabled by three factors of production: more capital, plus more labor hours worked, plus more total function productivity. However, in a landmark study from 2016, Accenture and Frontier Economics concluded that artificial intelligence could be thought of as a distinct factor of production because it combines aspects of the other factors and performs a catalytic function distinct from the others. As the trends editors see it, artificial intelligence is a special form of capital investment, which can substitute for many types of knowledge workers while enhancing total factor productivity. And while we agree about the distinctive mechanics of AI-based productivity enhancement, we believe that it's simply a more advanced way to achieve increased TFP. As highlighted in trend number one, we expect artificial intelligence to provide the general-purpose technological boost which will transform those gloomy forecasts. Typically, the use case for AI is presented as automating operations, such as customer service or improving decision-making through data analysis. Obviously, those solutions are important. That's why companies are spending nearly $50 billion on AI systems last year alone. The pandemic has been accelerating that trend. Moody's Analytics economist Mark Zandi says that many businesses have taken advantage of the pandemic to more fully deploy technologies and process changes that they were investing in but reluctant to take full advantage of during the good times. More important, however, is the role of AI as a super researcher. In a research paper titled, "Are Ideas Getting Harder to Find?", economists Nicholas Bloom, Charles Jones, and John Van Reenen show how it's been getting harder to discover the big advances and breakthroughs that drive technological progress and economic growth. The low-hanging fruit has been picked. Their conclusion? Just to sustain constant growth in GDP per person, the United States must double the amount of research effort every 13 years to offset the increased difficulty of finding new ideas. But as we've documented previously in Trends, artificial intelligence can go a long way towards solving this problem. Instead of thinking of AI as a general-purpose invention, some economists think of it as a general-purpose method of invention that can supercharge the research process. As a result, we believe that, consistent with Accenture's estimates, artificial intelligence will add 2% per year to average U.S. economic growth through 2035. That, in and of itself, will make all the difference between having a roaring 20s and a boring 20s. Given this trend, we offer the following forecast for your consideration. First, by 2035, artificial intelligence will dramatically impact the profitability of almost every industry, but the implications will be far greater for some industries than others. For example, AI has the potential to increase profits in education by 84%, while in utilities, Accenture estimates the potential profit impact at only 9%. Second, enabled by AI and super cheap gene sequencing, widespread commercialization of five nascent medical technologies will dramatically improve the productivity of healthcare. The first game changer is reprogramming the body to fight back against infectious disease and cancer using mRNA. The second is CRISPR gene editing technology, which is finally becoming reliable enough to therapeutically rewrite segments of a patient's genome, eliminating genetic defects. In silico drug discovery will directly harness the power of artificial intelligence to the problem of identifying promising therapeutic molecules. Combining these three technologies offers the possibility of slowing and even reversing human aging at some point in the 2020s. And combining AI with the Internet of Things and 5G networking opens the door to low-cost, truly effective telemedicine, anywhere, at any time. All of this will combine to bend the healthcare cost curve in ways few expect. The key is ensuring that regulatory constraints don't undermine benefits. Third, telecommuting combined with AI-based self-driving taxis and autonomous delivery vehicles will reduce the share of income households devote to local transportation. Most families will own just one car or none. Highways will be far less congested despite larger populations, and parking garages will be repurposed. Many car-related businesses will become obsolete, and many large markets will be served by flying taxis, which will also become autonomous by 2035. The net result will be increased safety, lower cost, and a better experience. Fourth, space will become a major business destination as launch costs drop by a factor of 200. Payload launch costs to low Earth orbit, or LEO, which were $65,400 a kilogram with the space shuttle, are now at $2,600 a kilogram for SpaceX Falcon 9. But now, SpaceX is talking about $10 a kilogram with its new Starship. And because Starship is designed to be refuelable in orbit, you will be able to launch 150 tons to LEO, refuel while orbiting Earth, and then fly the same payload the rest of the way to the moons of Jupiter. That's exciting. But the real impact may be more pedestrian. Meta-analyses have found that trade volume on Earth has roughly inverse linear relationship to transport costs. If that relationship holds true for space, a 200 times cost reduction in travel between Earth and LEO should increase trade between Earth and LEO by 200 times. Commerce between the Earth and the Moon, or between Earth and Mars, starting from a base close to zero, would be stimulated even more. We will have to wait to see exactly what this portends. Fifth, for the next 20 years, fossil fuels will dominate global energy markets despite the best efforts of environmentalists. Emerging economies can't afford the cost and unreliability of today's renewables. Natural gas will dominate North American electrical production because it's clean, cheap, and abundant. China and India will rely heavily on coal. However, by the end of the decade, small-scale nuclear and advanced geothermal will both become cost-competitive and will dominate the second half of the 21st century. Without heavy subsidies, solar and wind will become competitive for intermittent applications, only if storage technologies can be substantially improved. Meanwhile, dramatically improved heating and air conditioning technologies, coupled with the transportation changes discussed earlier, will reduce demand in the advanced economies while making upgrades in emerging markets more affordable. So, barring extreme political pressure, energy costs will not hinder economic growth in the coming years. And sixth, the biggest impact of artificial intelligence will be in terms of scientific discovery and product development, where whole industries will be built around discoveries that could not have even been made without the use of AI. The protein folding breakthrough mentioned earlier is only the latest of many blockbuster examples. Back in February, MIT researchers reported that a computer model which can screen more than 100 million chemical compounds in a matter of days, is designed to pick out potential antibiotics that kill bacteria while using different mechanisms than those of existing drugs. Similarly, Wired magazine reported on InnoBat, a Slovakia-based company which is using a U.S.-developed AI platform to analyze different lithium battery chemistries 10 times faster than what was previously possible. And this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to harnessing the unique abilities of AI to do game-changing scientific research. Since this technology is still in its infancy, the trends editors expect to see a whole wave of previously unimagined solutions, which will form the basis for new companies and even new industries.
Trend number 3, the great 2020s equity opportunity. In a nutshell, the trends editors believe that we are in the middle of a cyclical bull market driven by liquidity. That market cycle is playing itself out in the context of a secular bull market driven by technology. The cyclical bull market may run for another year or more before suffering a relatively brief correction. On the other hand, the secular bull market is likely to last at least another 10 years and resemble the secular bulls which began in 1950 and 1982. Contrary to what you're hearing from many corners, forward valuations of equities are still fairly cheap, especially when compared to other asset classes. Earnings per share will continue to grow on average because, as we explained in trend number 1, the underlying economy is in far better shape than most people realize, and this provides a solid foundation for a business rebound. As a result, we remain cautiously optimistic about stocks in the short term and very optimistic about them in the long term. Let's examine these conclusions and see why they make sense. We'll start with valuations. Today's skeptics rely upon trailing valuations, specifically PEs based on recent earnings, to make the case that stocks are overvalued and probably in a bubble. This argument ignores the fact that the market is a discounting mechanism which is trying to properly price future earnings. Past earnings don't have much relevance to stock prices except for guiding estimates of future earnings. When we invest our money in a stock, we don't invest because of how much money the company made in the past. We care about how much money we think it will be making in the future. That is, we want to share in the company's future profits. Consider this situation in early 2009. The S&P 500 index bottomed at around 750, while the 12-month trailing earnings for the index came in at $8 per share. This resulted in a trailing PE of 100, which implied that stocks were extremely expensive by historical standards. That was because we were in a deep recession and many companies in the index reported either a loss or razor-thin profits. However, the forward PE told a different story. The companies making up the index were expected to earn $75 per share in the next year, which meant that the forward PE of the index was 10. This indicated that stocks were extremely cheap, and buying stocks in early 2009 turned out to be a very smart decision. Now, fast forward to 2020, when we are again seeing a market with a large gap between trailing PEs and forward PEs. Currently, the S&P 500 sits at roughly $37.50 against trailing earnings of $135 per share and forward earnings of $195 per share. That gives us a trailing PE of 28 and forward PE of 19. So, what is a proper PE value for the current market? Many people point out that the 100-year average historical PE of the S&P 500 is 14, so they argue that 14 should be our benchmark value. However, the rather simplistic logic behind this conclusion doesn't hold water. Why? When you look beneath the 100-year average of the index, you see a very long period in the 1970s and 1980s where the average PE was around 10. Specifically, you have a period from 1975 to 1985 where the average PE was 9, which was also a period of high inflation and high bond yields. But does this have any relevance today, in a completely different environment with low bond yields and low inflation? A more relevant approach is to focus on the last 30 years, when average P/E ratios were higher. Specifically, the average P/E ratio for the S&P 500 over the 30-year period, between 1990 and 2020, was 24. And notably, this includes an 18-year period between 1990 and 2009 with high interest rates. This makes the current forward P/E of 19 look pretty cheap. Furthermore, a quick examination of P/E ratios and returns shows that the best times to buy stocks has, in fact, been when the trailing P/E has been the highest, such as in 2001 and 2009. There are additional reasons why we can't compare current stock valuations to the 80s, the 70s, or earlier periods. In 1980, the average P/E of the market was 8. But when you look under the hood, you see that 6 out of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 index were oil companies, and the other 4 were industrials. The biggest tech company in the index was IBM. Compare that to today's index, where the biggest companies are Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft. As the index has become more tech-savvy over the last few decades, it has come to support a higher valuation overall. So it's not fair to expect today's market to have the same valuation as the 80s or the 70s, when the stocks in the index looked nothing like they did back then. One big difference in tech companies and old-line industrials is the relative investment in intangible assets, which are expensed rather than capitalized. Because tech companies rely so much more on intangibles, they have inherently higher P/E ratios than industrial firms. A much more relevant metric is price to free cash flow. On that basis, the S&P 500 is also relatively cheap. More importantly, we can't look at equity valuations in a vacuum because all assets are valued in comparison to alternative assets. Historically, the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yield is considered to be a good comparison against stocks because it is an investment theoretically free of default risk. Notably, the long-term trend of the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yield has been downward for the 40 years covering the period between 1980 and 2020. This downtrend is persistent and is unlikely to change anytime soon. What's the implication? A forward P/E of 19 represents an earnings yield of 5.3%. The 10-year Treasury is currently yielding 0.8%. Based on this metric, stocks look dirt cheap. The second and most important factor favoring stocks is that earnings per share for the broader market, as well as for select companies and sectors, are likely to continue to rise rapidly. Three principal factors are likely to drive S&P 500 earnings per share up roughly 19% over the next 2 years. These include 7% from revenue growth, 6% from margin expansion, and 6% from a mix of other factors. Now let's turn our attention to the third crucial factor creating a favorable environment for stocks, the amount of liquidity in the economy. In the last 10 years, the Federal Reserve has been printing money at an unprecedented rate, and that printing accelerated further last year. As of year-end 2020, the M2 money supply passed $19 trillion. While a good chunk of this money is already invested in stocks, over $4 trillion is still sitting in checking and savings accounts across the country, earning a negative real return. In the next few years, much of this money will be deployed in the stock market. Specifically, the kind of cash surge that we're seeing has enabled companies to make significant buybacks of their shares, driving up share prices in the process. Meanwhile, much of the rest will enter the real economy, boosting corporate profits. As such, this money will help stocks appreciate both in direct and indirect ways. To demonstrate the implications of rising liquidity for stock prices, consider the correlation between central bank liquidity and the prices of tech stocks. Over the past 5 years, the surge central bank assets has been mirrored by a surge in the price of the Tesla share as well as the FANG stocks. And we expect this relationship to hold for the medium term. So, what does that mean for asset allocation decisions? As we highlighted in the August 2020 Trends issue, the conventional wisdom encourages investors to invest in a mix of debt and equity instruments in an effort to reduce risk. Unfortunately, this model is demonstrably flawed. History tells us that on average, stocks have outperformed bonds in every relevant time frame. Furthermore, there is every reason to expect that the performance gap between stocks and bonds will widen over the coming decade. After a 40-year decline, taking the 10-year Treasury bond yield to 0.8%, rates can only stay the same or rise. This means falling bond prices. So, holding bonds is likely to perform very badly versus holding a passive stock index ETF or a mutual fund. More importantly, as we also explained in the August 2020 issue of Trends, there are better ways to make money than simply buying a passive index fund. For example, the Pair 5 strategy only buys a subset of the companies that have the best EPS growth prospects, while Berkshire Hathaway only buys stocks that are fundamentally undervalued. Both value and growth strategies have worked superbly well at various times. The questions you need to ask are, which type of strategy is working now, and which type of strategy is likely to work in the future? One proxy for the group of companies with high EPS growth is the Russell 1000 Growth Index. A proxy for low PE companies that seem undervalued is the Russell 1000 Value Index. As of year-end 2020, the stocks in the Russell 1000 Value Index were demonstrably less attractive as a group than those on the Russell 1000 Growth Index, based on measures of earnings growth, returns, and risks. So, generally speaking, growth stocks appear more attractive than value stocks. But all growth stocks are not created equal. The prospects for some sectors and industries are far better than those for the broader market. This is where understanding trends in technology, demography, and human behavior come in. To understand this, let's look at the trends for several key industries for which the earnings trends are particularly exciting. One powerful trend involves prospects for the Internet of Things, or IoT, where data volumes are growing at a compounded annual rate of 34%. Another area experiencing exponential growth is 5G networking. After many years of anticipation, 5G finally reached commercialization in 2020. This explosive technology has roughly 100 million users today, but is expected to have 2.8 billion at the end of 2025. Digital transaction platforms, including both e-commerce sites and mobile payment processors, are growing at a compound rate of 16.5% annually. Payment processors like PayPal and e-commerce companies like Amazon have network effects that create business models with sustainable competitive advantage. Another highly promising sector is gene sequencing, which plays a crucial role in enabling new solutions utilizing mRNA, CRISPR, and in silico drug discovery technologies. Whether it's preventing pandemics, curing cancer, slowing aging, or minimizing heart disease and diabetes, genomics will play a central role. Over the past 12 years, the cost of sequencing a human genome has shrunk by a factor of roughly 2,000. And by the time it costs $100 to sequence a human genome in 2028, industry revenues will total $18 billion. What's the bottom line? The available evidence implies that growth stocks will deliver exceptional returns. During the golden age, the biggest winners in terms of capital gains will be companies that harness these six technologies in order to maximize market share and margins. Innovative business models, backed up with state-of-the-art technology, will win the day. And success depends on identifying the winners early on. Given this trend, we offer the following forecasts for your consideration. First, the secular bull market that started in 2013 is driven by a technology revolution, and it will last through the next decade. The golden age bull market of the mass production revolution ran from 1950 to 1973, with the S&P 500 rising 580%. The installation phase of the digital revolution ran 1982 to 2000, with the S&P 500 rising 1,098%. Obviously, past performance is no guarantee of future results, but what we've learned from prior techno-economic revolutions indicates that the secular bull market that started in 2013 has a long way to run. Second, the cyclical bull market, which started in late March 2020, will remain supercharged by liquidity and could well last another year, rising to 4,500 on the S&P 500. As you will recall, the trends editors called the bottom of the COVID-19 crash on March 22nd, and the market turned on March 23rd. From that starting point, the Pair 5 strategy used by the trends editors delivered a total return of 175% through January 21st, 2021. By the way, if you would like to find out more about Pair 5, call 630-399-1319 or email carolyn.thur@ampf.com. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 delivered 70% and the NASDAQ Composite delivered 91%. Looking ahead, S&P 500 companies are expected to grow earnings per share by 20% or more over the next 2 years, as discussed in the context of trend number one. And even more importantly, the world's central banks are committed to providing all the liquidity needed to return the post-pandemic economy to solid growth. Third, 2021 will see carefully selected growth stocks substantially outperform the indices as they did in 2020. When it comes to solid companies pursuing the five opportunities mentioned earlier, namely the Internet of Things, 5G, transaction platforms, genomics, and artificial intelligence, it makes sense to buy the dips. The exception to this rule involves macroeconomic surprises that will take down the indices as well as the growth champions. This could be as routine as a 10 to 20% technical correction to an overbought market, or as extraordinary as a COVID-like black swan. As we move into the second quarter, everyone should be increasingly alert for signs of the former healthy but painful event. Fourth, someday value stocks will be competitive with growth stocks, and it might even be in 2021. In January, the number of non-U.S. stock markets that had emerged from COVID-related corrections rose to 80%. Historically, this has been a very bullish sign for value stocks. As we've already seen with small-cap stocks, investments that have been left behind begin to catch up when the leaders appear overvalued. Value stocks were clearly left behind and have a chance to rally back to full value over the next few years. For example, over the 12 months ending January 21st, Berkshire Hathaway, with quintessential value stock, delivered a total return of just 2.42%, while the Morningstar Large Cap Growth Index delivered 34.95%. As the global economy recovers, expect to see value stocks move up strongly before plateauing. In the January 2021 issue of Business Briefings, we discuss this topic in more detail. And fifth, as interest rates inevitably rise, the conventional allocation of 60% stocks plus 40% bonds will not provide safety. While it's almost a certainty that stocks will rise long-term, bonds are almost as certain to fall. We're at the end of a secular decline in rates which began 40 years ago. Over four decades, the promise of ever lower rates enabled bondholders to realize capital gains on long maturity bonds. However, with 10-year treasuries yielding 0.8% and the economy poised for strong post-pandemic growth, there is nowhere for rates to go except up. Obviously, as rates rise, bond prices will fall. For those with substantial exposure to debt assets, much of the money they make on stocks will simply offset the losses they suffer on bonds.
Trend number four, the continuing crisis in Sino-American relations. The United States and China are running a superpower marathon, which may last a century. However, both history and China's recent trajectory suggest that Sino-American competition is likely to reach its moment of maximum danger during the 2020s. The reason is that China has reached a particularly perilous stage in its life as a rising power. It's at the point where it has gained the capability to dramatically disrupt the existing order, but recognizes that time is not on its side. What's the bottom line? America needs a sustainable, long-term strategy for managing and winning a protracted global competition. But more urgently, the United States needs a near-term strategy for navigating the danger zone. Most debate on America's China policy focuses on the dangers of a rising and confident China. But the United States actually faces a more complex and volatile threat, an already powerful but increasingly insecure China, beset by internal problems and a brewing international backlash. China already has the money and muscle to challenge the United States in key areas. But China's geopolitical window of opportunity may be closing as fast as it opened. Since 2007, China's annual economic growth rate has dropped by more than half, and China's productivity has declined by nearly 10%, meaning that it is spending more to produce less. Meanwhile, debt has ballooned eightfold and totaled 335% of gross domestic product at the end of 2020. No country in history has ever racked up so much debt so fast in peacetime. Furthermore, China has little hope of reversing these trends because it is about to suffer the worst aging crisis in history. Over the next 30 years, China will lose 200 million working-age adults and gain 300 million senior citizens. Any country that has aged, accumulated debt, or lost productivity at anything close to China's current pace has lost at least one decade to near-zero economic growth. And as economic growth falls, the dangers of social and political unrest rise. China's leaders are well aware of these trends. President Xi Jinping has given multiple internal speeches warning party members of the potential for a Soviet-style collapse. To limit their blowback, China's government has outlawed negative economic news, and Chinese elites are moving their money and children out of the country en masse. Meanwhile, China faces a rising wave of foreign hostility. According to leaked Chinese government reports and independent Western analyses, negative views of China have soared to highs not seen since the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989. This surge of anti-China sentiment is a response to Beijing's internal repression and external assertiveness, and is now manifesting in ways that threaten to crush China's geopolitical ambitions. Nearly a dozen countries have suspended or canceled their participation in Belt and Road Initiative projects. Another 16 countries, including 8 of the world's largest 10 economies, have banned or severely restricted use of Huawei products in their 5G networks. India has been turning hard against China since a clash between the two countries killed 20 soldiers in June. Japan has ramped up military spending, turned amphibious ships into aircraft carriers, and strung missile launchers along the